This Writers Centre Norwich podcast was recorded at the 2015 Noirage Crime Writing Festival in partnership with the University of East Anglia and Dead Good Books.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back. Welcome to Dragon Hall for those of you who have just joined us. Welcome to Noirage. It's great to have you here. So, this is midway through day three of our Crime Writing Festival, which is run in partnership with Dead Good Books and the University of East Anglia, and we're the Writers Centre Norwich, of course. I'd like to thank our funders, Arts Council England, Norwich City Council, Norfolk County Council, and our sponsors at the Business Improvement District for making these events possible. But also to you, the audiences, the readers, for coming along. It's great to have you here in Dragon Hall in such numbers. It's wonderful to have the Food Festival vibe down in the garden. So, on to The Kill of Women. The sharp-eyed amongst you may have detected that today's panel is, if he is a kill of women, in a very good disguise. But that is Paul Johnston, who is today's chair. I just wanted to hand you over to him by mentioning a few words about The Kill of Women. So they're this 16-strong group of crime writers, criminally good writers, their website tells me, and which was set up last year intending to promote women's voices across all levels of the industry. It includes people like Erin Kelly, Paula Hawkins and Anya Lipska, and it was founded and is sort of managed, I think, by MJ McGrath and Louise Miller. So it's a very, very exciting literary phenomenon at the moment. It's full of these writers who are winning prizes, winning awards, and who are also very, very entertaining to listen to. Today we have four of the killer women in the house, and we have Helen Giltrow, Kate Rhodes, Colette Macbeth, and Laura Wilson. Please welcome them. I'll hand over to Paul as the chair. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks, Jonathan. Am I audible at the back? Yes? Well, just a word about the female crime writing so-called collective. There was a bit of an argument about that in the green room just now. They prefer to be known as a ragtag bunch rather than a collective. We are, as you know from the programme, going to be talking about twists. But before we get to that point, I'm going to introduce the panel to you. Starting at the far end, where is sitting Kate Rhodes, who was born in London, studied at Essex, and has a doctorate about Tennessee Williams, Dr. Rhodes. She's taught at universities in the UK and in the US, and she lives in Cambridge. She won the Ruth Rendell Short Story Award in 2014, and her fourth novel, featuring the psychologist Alice Quentin, River of Souls, is out now. According to the Washington Post, it's a fast-moving, entertaining mixture of sex, suspense, and serial killers.
Yes. Thank you.
She has absolutely no connection with Cecil Rhodes or with Rhodesia. Have you been to the island of Rhodes?
I have, actually. Very nice.
Good.
Heartily recommend it.
I'm glad we got that sorted.
In fact, a really good place to set a crime novel, I'd say.
Right.
Keep that in mind.
I've already done a series of novels set in Greece, but not in Rhodes, though. Okay, that's Kate. Next to Kate is Helen Giltrow, who read history, modern history, at Oxford University, and she lives in Oxford still. She was a commissioning editor for the Oxford University Press for over 10 years. Her first novel is The Distance, which is out now. Her writing was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger and the Telegraph Novel in a Year competition. I'm not even going to ask what that means. The Distance was described by none other than Lee Child, and no less than Lee Child, as fast, hard, and very, very good. Bit heavy on the adverbs there, Lee. She describes herself as a part-time imposter on Twitter. Only part-time? And her first story concerned a shoal of daredevil fish.
That's a long time ago, I have to say. That I was five.
When she was five. as I was going to say, when you were five.
Yes,
and I think the sequel's coming out next year. Yeah. Laura Wilson, sitting in the middle, the blonde one, is...
This is why we don't have men in our
room. Yes,
Paul, can I just explain something just to clear this up in case any of the other gentlemen in the room are confused? Blonde, brunette and redhead are not actual personality types.
I think you've just proved the point. She, however, completely correct, she studied at Oxford and at London. Her latest novel is The Wrong Girl, which is actually set in Norfolk. She's well known for her Detective Inspector Stratton series, which is set in the 1940s and 1950s, and the first of which was Stratton's War, and won the CWA Ellis Peters Award, which, if you don't know what that means, is the historical dagger. She reviews crime for The Guardian and also teaches crime writing at the City University in London. According to The Independent, she's one of the country's most acute psychological crime novelists, and in her spare time she posts letters in espadrilles in the rain.
You've been reading Twitter.
Something a blonde would never do. And immediately next to me, I'm not even going to talk about her hair colour, is Colette Macbeth, who's not related, as far as I know, to the Queen, played by Marion Cotillard, opposite Michael Fassbender, in the film coming out soon. Her first novel was Precious Thing, and the second, which is out at the moment, is The Life I Left Behind, which was described by Marion Keyes as absolutely amazing, grip lit of the highest order. Now, I'd never heard of grip lit before. Has anyone else?
Well, you obviously don't follow Marion Keyes on Twitter. We like the term grip lit. I'm a fan of the term grip lit.
Do we know who originated it?
I think Marion Keyes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I prefer it to Chic Noir.
Well, Chic Noir and grip lit are surely not the same, are they?
Well, it depends who you're writing for. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think we're all kind of lumped together, but anything with a chicken doesn't get my vote.
A chicken?
Chicken.
Right, that's enough chickens. She studied French and Spanish at the University of Liverpool, and she worked as a journalist and a TV news reporter on Sky and BBC. Anyone seen her on the TV? Well, I know it. She's mainly remembered, apparently, for her coverage of the invasion of killer crabs around Norfolk. Is this true?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm remembered. My friends, I did a lot of big stories, but the ones that, you know, always stick with your friends are the ones where you look like a complete numpty, you know, on air.
About killer crabs. Were they killer crabs? Why were they killer crabs?
They were killer crabs. Apparently there was a whole load of American crabs that were invading British seas, and they were killing the indigenous crabs.
That's enough crabs, chickens and espadrilles. And let's move on to the subject of twists. Well, as you've seen from the programme, the question is whether a twist is essential or is a major component of a contemporary crime novel. Let's start with you, Helen. What do you think? Well, if you like, you can define twist.
Oh, no.
Okay, someone
no,
else can do that.
I would argue they're not necessary. But on the other hand, but when you're writing a crime novel, for me, at some level or other, you are withholding information from the reader all the time. You are trying to... And it just depends on what level you're doing that. Mm-hmm. On a basic narrative level, you could be just withholding something in one scene and then giving it to them in the next scene, but withholding something else. And all of those are small twists that will keep them reading. Or you can have the novels which are just dominated by one massive twist, which everybody talks about. But I don't think you need to restrict it to those big twists. Crime writers are writing small twists all the time. Mm-hmm. But you don't need to have the big one, I think, to have a really satisfying novel. And I certainly wouldn't start a novel thinking, oh, what's going to be my twist? I'd be starting by thinking...
Start writing.
Or even start thinking about writing it by thinking, oh, I must think of a big twist. Everyone starts at a different place. I start with characters and where they might go and what's going to happen.
And so you can't see what a twist is before you've constructed the characters.
Yeah.
Okay, Kate, what's your take on twists?
I was really cogitating while I was listening to Hannah, thinking, yes. I suppose thrillers have been hijacked by the twist, haven't they? If you think about, you know, the massive sellers like Gone Girl and I Let You Go, they're defined by their absolutely massive and spectacular twists. But for me, I suppose I like character-driven novels, like Helen's just described. I like to meander a bit, not necessarily be waiting for that sort of heart-stopping moment when suddenly the plot turns on a sixpence. I'm always very impressed by that, but I don't think it's absolutely essential to what we do. Having said that, I've tried it a couple of times. I don't know whether it's actually worked, but giving it a go. Yeah.
Laura?
Well, you know, as Helen was saying, twists are a function of plotting, and that doesn't matter whether it's a crime novel. I mean, if you think about Jane Eyre, the moment where they are about to get married and the chap comes in and he says, but, you know, he's married already, and he's bonkers Bertha in the attic. You know, loads and loads and loads of novels have twists. But I think that you're right. I think when it becomes a gimmick, and it's like, this is the thing the person first thought of, everything else is then arranged around that, and the books are sort of cooked in such a way that character plausibility is totally sacrificed. I mean, obviously, we know that, I think Graham Greene said this when he was talking about Patricia Highsmith, that the wonderful thing about Highsmith's characters, he said, is that very often, although we allow that real people in real life do act in very unpredictable ways, we somehow have a different set of standards when we read a book, such that this character is like this, and therefore they must proceed from A to B in good order. And what he liked about the Highsmith characters is that they don't. They take a sudden lift turn and end up with Z, which is why the books are so wonderful. And that's fine, but it takes a lot of subtlety, and you have to get it right. I think the danger of the, you know, the big twist, which is the whole thing, it's sold on and why everybody's reading, is that if you don't get it right, it falls flat on its nose. And speaking as a reviewer, I get between 20 and 30 books every week except Christmas. I don't read all of them, but I do read a lot of them, and I'm aware of the blurb and all that kind of thing. You can pretty much see from the blurb in the first few chapters whether this is going to go or not, I think, actually. And there's quite a lot that doesn't, because it's sold on a gimmick. And that's the problem with the high concept book. It begins with a bang and it ends with a whimper. And that's disappointing.
Okay, Colette, what's your take?
Well, I mean, I would love to say that no, twists don't matter, because they're bloody hard to pull off. And when you're writing a book, you know, that is part of the kind of pressure, isn't it? As a thriller writer, to think, well, how am I going to subvert expectations? How am I going to pull the rug from under readers' feet? You know, how am I going to pull off this trick? And it would be really lovely to think, oh, well, it doesn't matter. But personally, I think it does matter, because in a thriller, I think that there's almost a pact. Well, the kind of books I write, which are psychological thrillers, I think I enter into a pact with the reader whereby I allow them to make certain judgments, and then I will, you know, turn them on their head. And so I encourage people, you know, to make those judgments, and then I show people that they're absolutely wrong to do it. I think actually, and I've been doing a bit of research on Twitter and Facebook about, you know, is a twist important? And one thing that's come over massively, and this is kind of at odds with how publishers deal with it, is that people like twists, but they actually don't like to be told that there is a twist.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is not the author's fault that a reader is being told there's a big twist in their book, but it's something that publishers do to sell the book. So I Let You Go, Claire McIntosh, which is a great book and has a great twist in it. But, you know, I guess that there's a lot of people who would like to read that without knowing that there is a big twist. Because as soon as you know, you start looking for it. And that kind of detracts from the reading experience.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can distinguish then what you were saying before about characters. I wonder if we can distinguish between twists that are primarily to do with characters, all primarily to do with plot, maybe that's the high concept gimmick kind of thing you were talking about. Maybe also twists that refer to structure, and I'm thinking specifically about your latest novel here, where there's a, well, you can tell us what your structural setup is, which is a kind of twist, Colette.
Well, my latest novel is told from predominantly, there are three points of view, but mainly two characters, and one of them is living and one of them is dead. It's not a ghost story, I also have to say this, I haven't written a supernatural novel. But it is the story of two women who were attacked by the same man, and one of them survived and one of them died. And the one who died was actually investigating the first case as a miscarriage of justice. And of course, you know, the obvious conclusion that is drawn quite early on in the book is that she was trying to convince everyone of this man's innocence, and actually he killed her. And that is the structure.
And the thing with that twist is, the very, if I remember correctly, the very first word of the novel is Eva, which is the name of the dead woman. So what we normally think of with a twist is that suddenly the reader is caught off guard. In this case, of course, the reader isn't caught off guard, although they have to find out what the situation is with Eva. So what I'm trying to get at is, there a kind of twist which actually is much more subtle by not being a sudden twist?
I think that's what you were referring to, isn't it? You know, there's so many... I mean, really, what we're doing in twists is kind of keeping the reader interested, you know, and surprise... I mean, we all have to surprise the reader in different ways, and the twist is just one of very many ways that we can do that. So in The Life I Left Behind, I would say what I do there is employ lots of smaller twists whereby I peel back the layers of the character. And one of those right at the beginning is that there's a woman who's describing how she is found. And at the end of that chapter, and it's not giving too much away because it's right at the beginning of the book, you realise that she is dead and it's her body that she's just described.
Yes, I mean, when I read it, I didn't know that you were using the viewpoint of a dead person. Yeah. And I loved the fact that I got so far into this chapter going, what's going on here? And that was really fresh.
And again, it happens in, I can't remember how many pages, but it's not many pages, is it?
No, it's
4 pages or something.
I guess what I've just said is, in some ways, I'm glad I read that. I read the book without knowing that was what... although it's not a major... Sorry, we just ruined it for everyone.
There's got to be some spoilers.
There's loads of other twists in it as well. But these things that you can think of as twists happen at so many levels, and I suppose most good crime novels have a small twist every few pages.
And you use the image of pulling the rug out, which is one quick tug, which can happen with the supposedly dead person who comes back to life, the man who's actually a woman, or do it like that, you know.
The identical twin.
Or that thing. You're not allowed to do that unless they're flagged up before, though. That's
mentioned.
That's part of the Decalogue rules. Do you know about those? Ronald Knox, who... He was a like swanky Catholic chaplain to people like Evelyn Waugh, but he was also a writer of detective stories, which there's a reason, shall we say, they're not reprinted, but a good one, having tried to read one. He made what he called a Decalogue, which was 10 rules, which was the, as he thought, unbreakable contract between the reader and the writer of the straight golden age detective story. Okay, I can't remember all of them. Basically,
one of them was no Chinaman.
No Chinaman must feature in the plot. That was because the bigotry and prejudice at the time was such that if a Chinaman came, everyone would say, "Well, that must be the villain. Yeah. He must be bad." There must not be more than one secret passage. identical twins unless they're flagged up first, and the detective must not come to the conclusion just by intuition or like the light bulb moment. They must practice reason and logic.
And I think also the detective can't be the murderer, but this was post-murder of Ripper.
Yes, which is why a lot of people got quite arsy and wrote letters to the Times about the murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, which has a...
Big twist.
Big twist. I'm trying to say it without telling you what it is, but... they did actually write letters to the Times. I think it was 1926, and there was quite a lot going on then, but perhaps it was a slow news week.
I think there have been many crime writers since who have deliberately tried to take on those the Decalogue rules and subvert all 10 of them. Yeah. There was an American guy called S.S. Van Dyne who produced another list. I think it's even longer, actually, and even more factious, around the same time in the 20s. Whether they specifically refer to twists, I mean, certainly there's material in there that's germane to our discussion. What we're kind of moving towards is a position that says that twists are maybe a bit iffy, a bit dodgy.
No, I don't think... No, I wouldn't say that purely because I've got quite a big one in my next. Definitely not. No, I think the position that I would defend is that if you can pull off a great twist, then go for it. But a lot of these twists, if you talk to the authors, happen organically. So one of our fellow killer women, Erin Kelly, has a fantastic twist in her book, The Burning Air. But actually, if you talk to her, she didn't set out to write that twist. It happened because she was she'd written a large part of the book and her publisher had said to her, I think that you should change the identity of the villain, if you like, in the piece. And so, therefore, it so happened that, you know, she'd written this in such a way that there could be a huge big twist. I think if you come up with a twist, as you said, and then organise everything around it, your book is going to be very one-dimensional. And also, you know, readers are really, really savvy, unfortunately, because we have to keep on... You have to try really, really hard to hoodwink readers. And there will always, always be a percentage of readers who guess. And if your book is just about the twist and those readers have guessed it, you know, it's gone for them.
Interesting, because I was thinking the other day about what Ruth Rendell said about twists, that she always wrote her essentially whodunits, I guess you could say, with Ruth Rendell, without deciding who the killer was going to be. She wrote the first draft thinking, the killer will be who it is. So she wrote the first draft, and then once she got her first draft out there, she decided to make her killer. And I think if you always, when you start your book, have in mind exactly who the killer is and how you're going to twist the story so everybody has that amazing moment at the end when they think, blooming heck, how on earth can that be? Then you can kind of trip yourself up, I think. So I think I'm with Ruth Rendell. Write your first draft and then figure out who the killer's going to be. Mm. Make everybody...
I tend to change my mind about 75% of the way through writing, which means that a lot of crime writers do this. I think probably most of them. It means that you have to plot backwards as well as forwards, because you have to go back and turn all the signposts the other way, so to speak.
Yes.
So you're kind of writing it twice. But that is quite a good technique, because I think your unconscious, you know, does the twist for you. It tricks you.
Do you think?
And I think that's good.
Do you think to some extent your twist has to surprise you?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Well, and that's why it doesn't work if you start out with a twist.
Yeah.
There's something else that just occurred to me that, you know, one of the, when we were discussing this panel beforehand, was kind of the tyranny of the twist and have readers come to expect it. I almost wonder whether a friend of mine described a lot of psychological thrillers and thrillers as a kind of drug, and she gets a fix from them. And now that she's started to read all those kind of books, she finds it very difficult to read something much slower pace. And I wonder whether the twist gives a reader a high, and the more, I mean, you can all answer this for me, but I can't answer it myself, but the more you become accustomed to books with those really sort of high, you know, moments.
High concert ones,
Then are you going to be disappointed by one that doesn't?
Yeah, just to throw a bit of pseudoscience into the mix here. A study was done at the University of Ohio with a sample of readers, which concluded that, I'm not kidding, they must have got funding
for this. How big was the sample?
Several hundred. It wasn't huge, but some. Individuals, readers with low self-esteem, didn't like twists, because if they'd formed an opinion of who the murderer would be, they didn't want that to be confounded. But readers who had a high self-esteem enjoyed the process of trying to guess and liked it if their expectations were wrong-footed or subverted.
Do you think the people with low self-esteem actually felt that they were stupid because they hadn't got it?
I think so.
Should we have a show of hands of who likes twists now and who doesn't?
Yes, tell us about that.
Then we can figure out the
self-esteem. Who likes twists? No one.
No one likes twists. Quite a lot of people like twists.
Not that many. Okay, maybe half, maybe 40%.
That they linked it with what they called, in I suppose psychobabble, the need to cognate, which is how much people like thinking deeply about the book they're reading.
Yes.
You know, because sometimes, I don't know about you, but I read something and I just want to be bamboozled. I don't even try. I'm happy. But
so you've got seriously high self-esteem there, Laura.
Yeah, clearly.
That's why you are a killer woman, of course. The self-esteem is riding high.
Indeed.
Yes, I'm feeling completely confounded here. Yes, Colette.
One thing, I think that we all want our books to be discussed because word of mouth is really, really important. And I think a big twist makes your book more discussable. I know that's not a word. And I do, you know, think that that's probably why publishers like them as well, because they become, you know, maybe the rest of the book is only as good as another book that you've read or is not as good, but that point that you can go, oh my goodness, did you read that book? Did you guess the twist? I mean, Gone Girl, for instance, we were all talking about Gone Girl before. I personally love Gone Girl, but, you know, would it have worked without the twist? I don't think so. Would enough people have talked about it if it didn't have that twist? I don't know. It's like that advert that I was it for the Independent or the Guardian years ago, where you kind of see this skinhead running around the corner and you think he's going to basically rob somebody in the street, and actually he's saving them. And I think that comes back to what we're all trying to do. We're trying to allow you to build up judgments of people and then turn them around, and that goes back to the twist, really.
Yeah. Mm. One of the criticisms that's been levelled at so-called golden age crime fiction, i.e. Agatha Christie through D.L. Sayers, and people are still writing the same kind of thing today, is that it's like a game, or it's like solving a crossword puzzle, and it doesn't get very profoundly into the characters. Mm. Now, some of the twists that we've either mentioned or that you might have thought of could be seen as kind of ludic, as kind of game issues. Do you think that sort of lowers the quality of the final book necessarily?
I think the book has to be more than... I think this keeps coming up. Yeah. The book has to be about a lot more than just its twist. Mm. Even if the twist is the fantastic marketing hook, if that was all it was, there were so many things that you could talk about in Gone Girl. There were gender issues buried in there. Mm. For some people, it was a very accurate portrait of a marriage, which was quite a scary idea. A marriage is
like myself.
In middle America as well, but on a societal level.
Not in middle England. We don't have marriages like that.
But if all there is a twist, then
not even a golden age novel, to be fair, would be only a twist. I mean, not even Agatha Christie, the most, kind of thinly characterised novel or whatever. It's not just a twist, is it?
But with the you know, what you call the ludic thing, the puzzle, those, by and large, and there are exceptions to every rule, the golden age novels are sort of emotionally neutral.
Yes.
You know, it's not an accident that they became very popular after the appalling horrors of the First World War, and at roughly the same time as the crossword puzzle and Pelmanism and Mahjong and all those other things. You know,
they were just...
ghost photos and the whole bit. And it was maybe, I don't know, you could say it was a reaction to all this appalling loss and horror and tragedy. But then...
Why would a puzzle or a game?
Well,
or
takes
a twist
your mind off stuff. It's escapism. Right. It's a nice story, and you don't have to be emotionally invested too much with Miss Marple or Poirot. But then, as somebody, I think Anthony Berkeley sort of posited, that the crime novel mutated and it became another sort of puzzle, which is the puzzle of character, which is what you're talking about.
Yes, actually, when you were just talking, I wondered then if the modern action thriller is actually the equivalent to the Golden Age novel, which is basically just giving you a fairly simple range of actions and some very immediate sort of emotional satisfactions based on the fight, the chase, the reveal, another fight, another chase, another reveal. You know, done well, it's like fast food. Done badly, it's dull with paper-thin characters. But I wonder if that's the modern equivalent of the puzzle crime novel, because it's constructed to do just one thing, which is take your mind off the outside world in a fun way.
And of course, if you're moving at warp speed, then your characters can be as thin as a CD side on.
Exactly,
it really doesn't matter because. But I think actually that is a slight problem with any book that you're reading fast and turning the pages. You kind of miss nuances. Mm. And with underpants over the trousers thrillers, it doesn't really matter.
It's almost as good as Griblet. Okay.
Too long.
Well, that depends on the underpants. Right, let's move on. Is there a kind of moral, ethical side to this in terms of how the author treats the, I don't know, implied reader. Obviously, I mean, it's impossible for the author. I don't know what you guys do, but not guys do. Do you sit down and think, you know, if I do this, will the reader think that? Am I pushing this too far? Is it kind of morally dubious what I'm doing to the reader here?
Yes, I think morality, I have to say, I sound really kind of like a moral human being, which I guess I'm probably not, really.
Crime writers can't be, yeah.
I think there is a moral dimension to what we're doing. We're writing about good and evil, after all, aren't we? And the character that I've just written five books about, my character is a forensic psychologist, is constantly doing those checks and balances between good and evil. And I suppose when I set out to write a book, I don't really set out to write a killer twist. I set out to write a real character doing a real job. Because I think when I read a thriller, I want to feel immersed in a world that feels very much like my own. I want to feel this is a real character with real dilemmas, some of which will be moral. So I think, yes, there's a real morality to what we're doing, the good and the bad. Because at the end of the process, when you've written this book and it's on the shelves of Waterstones, if you're very, very lucky, given how few thriller writers they actually stock these days, you have to stand by it, the message that you're giving, you know. And maybe I'm going to say something really contentious, but here we are, killer women with one very beautiful honorary male. I think...
I'll bear you up.
One of the things that I'm trying to do, because I'm ancient, is be a feminist as well. You know, the F words. I think you've got to stand by the morality of how you represent men and women, good and bad, the kind of moral universe that you create. I think it's important.
Okay, but tie that to twists, if you will.
Yeah, I think it, you know, I suppose I'm just saying really that I don't set out to write a twist. They happen because that's the genre. Readers expect a twist of some sort. And it kind of interested me in a way that my first book, The Sun, bless them, said this book is packed with exciting twists and turns. It's very articulate for The Sun. I was chuffed to bits. I nearly got it emblazoned on my T-shirt. But I think, you know, I suppose I'm just thinking, well, twists don't matter to me that much, although I have to do them because I'm a crime writer. But morality does.
That's very interesting. Helen, do you feel that you have to do them? I kind of guess from what you said before that you don't feel you have to do them.
I think there's a definite, for me, there's a definite contract with the reader that you are, as Colette was saying earlier, you are going to set them on a particular course, mm-hmm. which is actually not the true course. And then you're going to reveal to them further down the line that
there's actually a lying contract. Don't sign this contract.
Absolutely. No, I think, I mean, every time, for me, the current crime writer who I always think of in terms of twists is Sophie Hannah. Mm. Every time I open a Sophie Hannah book, I feel there's a competition between us, which I am going to lose because she will think of a twist that I am not going to spot. But I enter into that with joy in my heart because it's like, yeah, bring it on, Sophie. What have you got for me this time? And I think there is a puzzle element in crime novels, and that's one of, for me, it's part of the joy of constructing them. But that's only one level of the crime novel, and there are so many other levels.
I was going to say exactly that, and you know this from all your reviewing and your general knowledge of the genre, Laura, that there are many kinds of crime novels that actually have nothing to do with twists whatsoever. The noir novel, perhaps, I mean, there are noir novels that have twists, but there are plenty of others that don't.
As a reader, I get enormous pleasure out of a slow-motion car crash. You know, that's something that's... inevitable and it's terrible and nothing on earth is going to stop this because either it's the characters themselves or what, you know, because, you know, a twist could be a good thing, reversal of fortune, somebody's suddenly left £1 million or wins it, it could be anything, but that slow motion car crash, if well handled, I think that has an almost mesmeric quality which is different from the hook. And I think is just as powerful. But I think ultimately the single best way to create suspense, I mean, never mind twists and tricks and all the rest of it, is to make your readers care about the character. Yeah. I mean, that you know, there's one answer to that question and it's really simple and it's that. Character. And those are the best books.
Yeah. Colette, do you want to add something on that?
Well, just that you were talking about morality and twists, and I think I would add to that I think a twist in a novel can add to the morality of the novel because, again, I think we learn through having our judgments subverted. And I think, you know, not that I would ever set out to teach people a lesson, but in life, when I make a judgment about somebody and then I find out that I'm completely wrong, I think that, you know, enhances me as a person, and kind of it is a moral thing, because I have allowed myself to for my prejudices, if you like, have led me to make a specific judgment. The twist actually does play a really important part in a crime novel, if you're going to talk about morality, because that's, you know, how we learn that we're all wrong and that we all should keep a much more open mind.
I can actually remember when I was writing my first, at the moment, only published book, the moment when that occurred to me, that twists actually do have this moral dimension, that you have actually asked your readers to believe that certain characters are good and certain characters are evil, or at least the villains, starker word. Mm. And the most effective twists are the ones that turn their assumptions on their head and then cause them to question what the judgments they have made, perhaps on very flimsy evidence that you've given them. And I remember that as a revelation. It just hit me in the kitchen one morning, and I saw a lot of things very differently after that.
Yeah, I love those books that kind of prove to you that good and evil aren't necessarily diametrically opposed. Mm. There's that very fascinating grey area in the middle. And that's the twist for me when I start thinking, hang on, I thought that was a bad thing to do. Maybe it's not so bad after all.
That's a very Patricia Highsmith thing.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. Okay, let's talk about, shortly, I'm going to throw this open to the floor, so get your thinking caps on for interesting questions, please, otherwise I should be running around yelling at you. Let's talk about the technicalities of this a bit, because people in the audience audiences are often very interested to know how authors actually go about writing their books and so on. I mean, let's not just talk about twists, but in terms of twists are basically a plot-related thing, I would say. I mean, in as much as you can distinguish character from plot, like, okay, Aristotle did this, and we were talking before about, you know, great twists, and I can remember Oedipus Rex, which of course has one of the great twists of all time when...
the mother did it.
Well, when he finds out that he's been to bed with his mother and killed his father. Yeah, no wonder Freud got excited. Okay, so there's character and plot separated, which Aristotle does in his Poetics. But actually, as a practicing crime writer, is that feasible? Can we separate character from plot? Can we separate twist from character? I mean, we're kind of saying not, but let's go into the detail, Laura, a bit more about how you go about writing a novel.
She's good at this.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think I am. She put me on the spot.
No, let me just change that. Colette's going to
She's pretty good as well.
You've got 5 seconds to say something. Come on.
No, I'm not actually sure that you can. Do you know what this reminds me of? I did English literature at university, and you get George Eliot, which came first, character or plot, and you just want to piss off, you know. But
bloody Oxford University.
I don't think you can... If you write character-led books, which we all do, I don't think you can separate the two things. Yeah. But I think you can sort of tease things out, and I think how it works is that you trust your subconscious and you get X way through. I remember I was writing my first novel, which took just ages. It took about 6 years. I had a proper job and all that. And there is a death. A little boy is killed by somebody. And we know that one of the narrators is his older sister, and she, right from the beginning of her life, she's cold, she's manipulative, and there are all sorts of good reasons for this. And then right at the end, she has realised that her other brother, with whom she has been having an affair with, is about to leave her for somebody else. And so she tells him that she killed a child. He then kills her and himself, and unfortunately also the housekeeper. Collateral damage.
And the milkman?
No, not the milkman, but these are the three people who've been narrating the book, so we've got very, very close to them. And I actually couldn't decide in my own mind if this character had actually killed the little boy when she was a little girl, or had simply said it, and it comes back to morality, because actually, is it worse to murder somebody yourself with your hands than to cause somebody else to do it what you will not do for you. Mm. And that's a plot function, but it comes back to that character.
Character, yeah.
Even if I myself as the author couldn't decide.
I'm glad you brought the subconscious in, because I do think this is floating around this discussion, actually. I mean, and it sounds like, I mean, twists sound like they should be something pretty mechanical. You know, you get to a point and you decide, yeah. or you're, well, okay, so let's talk about the subconscious. What happens in that sense, Kate, in terms of your, say, in terms of your plotting? Try and separate the characters slightly.
You want me to slip deep into my subconscious?
No, I want you to tell me...
he's going to hypnotise
me.
Yes, watch this pen. You're the psychologist. You've got the psychologist. No, I mean, is the subconscious something that you let loose when you're writing, put it that way?
Yeah.
Do the twists come out? Do the characters come out of the subconscious?
I think you may have hit upon something there.
Oh, I think Laura did.
Mr. Johnson and Ms. Wilson as well, actually. But I think it's a weird process, right?
Dr. Johnson, actually.
Oh, Dr. Johnson, oh, gosh. Yeah. Even posher than I thought. I think that when you go into the first draft of a novel, it's almost like you're entering a sort of fugue state. You know, you sort of spew out your first draft and just get it down on the page as best you can, I think, really. And you go into a kind of mesmeric state. When definitely, I think, if it's really cooking, if you're really burning and you're knocking out the words every day, it becomes like a dream journey, I think. Stav Shiraz is nodding his head. His lovely novels have got a definite dreamlike quality to them, I think. I think if you're lucky and it's going well, then your subconscious comes to the fore, and I'm sure that includes the pivot on which your novel turns, the twist, just kind of bubbles up to the surface. Not wanting to make it sound too magical, because it isn't, it's a job. You know, we do it with a lot of passion, but ultimately it's a job. But I think that first wonderful experience of writing the first draft can be very mesmeric, and I think it is to do with the subconscious, for me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Colette, does that square with your writing experience?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I want to come on Kate's dreamy journey, because my first drafts are like pulling teeth, so... I don't think any of us can write without it. You completely rely on the subconscious, and sometimes, actually, you know, although we do have to put our bum on a seat every day, and as Kate said, it is a job, you know, you can't wait for inspiration, but sometimes you can't actually force that inspiration, and you do just have to almost let things stew and percolate a bit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find is that there's certain times of the day where my subconscious thoughts rise to the surface, and I don't carry a notepad around with me as you, every writer is told that they should, because I'm really forgetful and I'd lose it everywhere and that would stress me out. But I do always have a notepad by the side of my bed and a pen. Brilliant. And what I don't get to sleep that quickly in the evening, and you know, I find that sometimes I might just be reading a book and then they'll come, or I could be lying in bed with the light off and all those thoughts come. And so I will often be found writing in the dark.
So you do write them down?
Well, I do write them
down. Because I thought you were saying that you were writing down them would be...
No. I'm saying that during the day they don't really happen, because I'm too, you know, I'm like, oh, I've got to pick up this child here and, you know, trying to get as many words written before 3 o'clock or whatever. But and what I'm saying is that there you do have to allow yourself that time to think, and my time to think comes at night when everybody else is asleep or it's quiet, and quite often I don't even because my husband will be asleep, I don't turn the light on. I'll just get my notepad and I'll write in the dark the ideas.
You can get some great
notes. Yeah, I'll read it the next morning. But, so yeah, you know, it does happen, and I think that's really important. I mean, some people work early in the morning.
Helen, let's get your view on that, and then I'm going to open the floor.
Subconscious, very, very important. Kate was asking me how the next one's going outside when we're standing on the lawn, and I said to her, I couldn't tell you what the plot, but I know what it feels like, and I could draw the shape of it.
That's
and having got to that stage, I am really, really confident now that I can write it. Having gone through a horrible first draft that I hated,
and I
had a I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about this. I had a phone call with my editor, several phone calls with my editor, which was basically me asking permission to trash most of the first draft.
We've all been there.
The editor was saying, "Yeah, yeah, yeah."
Well, yes, he said. In the end, he said, "Yeah, if that's
what you want to do. Mm. If you feel it's not working, get rid of it. But it's been a long process to get to this stage where I suddenly think, I've got no notes on it. Or I've changed the plot completely. I've got no notes on it, but I know what it feels like. And I think that's probably because I've reached the stage where my subconscious is actually fully engaged with it. I tried to sit down and write notes about it about 3 weeks ago, and I wrote one sentence on a piece of paper, walked to my laptop, opened a new document, started writing, went straight into it. I only had the first page. And by the second page, a character had walked in that I had no idea I was going to write, and already it was like, oh, actually, at the end of the book, this is going to happen. And I hadn't, it starts falling into place as you do it, but only if I can get my subconscious on board. And I spent a long time getting there.
Laura, just briefly, you wanted to add something?
No, all I was going to say is it is noticeable, because I do a sort of variation of that with the fugue thing, and then I plot like mad, and when my need to control has got out of control, that's when I drop it and trust my subconscious, but that always has to happen. But it is noticeable if you follow writers' careers. I'm not going to mention any names, it will be invidious. Three wonderful novels, or the first four are wonderful, then it starts, got one a year, and it's this delivery date, and the thing becomes mechanical. Mm-hmm. There'll then be a couple of years' break, and they'll be wonderful again. And what I think has happened to the three or four that are mechanical is that the contents are insufficiently marinated. Mm-hmm. Mm. If you see what I mean.
That rings true.
And yeah. I know this sounds kind of wanky and pretentious, but I do think it's really important.
That sounds true. Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds
true. Right, thank you very much for the time being the panel. Let's throw it open then to the floor. Who would like to... maybe you'd like to give us an example of a book or a film with a plot twist that you're particularly impressed by, or what do you think about plot twists? Yes, Henry.
How do you stick with this thing about the subconscious for a minute? And what I'm interested in here from the panel, a lot of authors, a lot of writers, Nabokov included, believe that the writer has to be in complete control. Are you implying then, that all of you seem to be coming with the same opinion here on allowing the subconscious to come through, where are you with this idea of being in control?
Can we be in control and allowing the subconscious some kind of free reign? Is that feasible, Colette?
I don't think that I would disagree. I think I'd disagree with Nabokov. I don't feel that I'm in control of the plot that is, again, this sounds like nonsense, the plot that is driven by my character, but I allow my character to drive that. Does that make sense?
Sounds good. Driving metaphor is a good one, isn't it?
So, for instance, in my first novel, Precious Thing, I had set out to write it in a particular way, and the character would not be the person I wanted her to be. And funnily enough, Eve, in The Life I Left Behind, she wasn't right. I kept on writing, she wasn't right. And it was only when I worked out who they were that the rest of the book flowed. So I can't control it. And I think it'd be quite one-dimensional, you know, because, I mean, I do... Rachel in Precious Thing definitely took charge. She was definitely in control. It wasn't... It really wasn't... Me
you
in the end.
Another way and say actually it took you a while to get into control of it.
You could, but then we're getting down to semantics, aren't we? we could argue that for ages. But all I can tell you is that the sense I had when I was writing it, that it was only when I allowed my characters free rein and I backed off with the plan that I had for them that the novel happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Kate, you were talking about your fugue state. Where does control come into that? Probably not. Afterwards.
Yeah, there's an element of control. I think it's interesting you said that, Henry, because I was actually thinking about your very clever campus novel asked. Very interesting, and I'm sure that was quite highly controlled. It's a fascinating intellectual work. But I think, for me, I like to write a synopsis first before I allow my fugue state to kick in. It's like driving with your hands quite loose on the wheel. I think, you know, it may twist and turn and the journey may take you in places you don't expect. But I think if you don't have any blueprint or map at all, that's a very unsafe place to be. So I'd say, my foot's in both camps. I like to let my kind of I like to let the process be like a fugue, but I like to know where I'm going on the journey, I think. If that makes any sense.
I'm not sure if I'm going to let you drive me anywhere. Laura, control, stroke, subconscious?
I start off with really tight plotting, and as I said before, it's when my need to control gets out of control. It's kind of like then my subconscious knows where it's going, and it can sort of take over, and, you know, the right doors pop open. But I think it's also to do with, if you're thinking about something a lot, it's like, does anyone remember Fuzzy Felt? Things, you know, it's like when you learn a new word and it's everywhere, things kind of glom onto the surface of your mind much more because you're very engaged with it. I mean, I don't think there's anything particularly mystical about that. I think that's true of any endeavour, really.
I have learnt that if I think about subject matter with my intellect and I try and work something out, I come up with the plots that are the same as everybody else has written. And it's also very clear, and my editor has pointed this out to me, he says, you're thinking here, stop thinking. As far as I'm... he can see when I'm doing it, and he's always kind of picking me up on it and saying, not that.
The trick is to grow a very large amount of cannabis in your garden. Go out, pick it.
Well,
don't try this at home.
Don't get any work done.
For me, the subconscious basically provides... It's awful talking about the subconscious as if I have a relationship with it, because it's my subconscious, so obviously I don't.
Well,
I wouldn't know about it, though, would I? Because it's subconscious.
It's a continuum, isn't it?
It is a continuum, but if I try and work something out, it becomes laboured. Whereas if I can relax...
Yeah.
The material that sort of floats to the surface, I find, is the stuff that I wouldn't have come up with if I had sat down with my pen in my hand and tried to work it out. I then have a choice about how I use that material. And also the process of putting that material down on paper, technique starts cutting in. All the things that you learn from writing start coming to the... So there's all sorts of manipulation that then goes on with that material. You're not splurging your subconscious straight out onto the page. But I think it's the subconscious is something that you manage and you control, but it's got to be there.
Well, I'm not sure if Nabokov is the best example. I mean, are we supposed to take everything Nabokov said as being what he... Anyway, leave that one.
You can tell the questioner works at UEA, say.
Let's not take the mickey out of him anymore. Anyone else like to jump in with a comment about twists and so on? Come on, you must have read a novel with a big twist that either... Yes, madam.
I was thinking to ask a question, it maybe sounds a bit basic, but how do you define a twist? Because I've seen people distinguish between the twist and the reveal and argue that they're very different. And I wondered what you thought the difference was between a classic twist and the process of revelation and finding out more that is part of every novel.
Oh, that's a good question. Anyone? I define a good question by not having the answer to it. I would say a reveal, this is just off the top of my head, but a reveal for me is something much more subtle that we do all the time. And so, you know, I think any book, not just a thriller or a crime novel, would be full of a lot of reveals. I think the twist is almost a complete gear change. So, for instance, going back to Gone Girl, I mean, that completely, the whole novel sort of swung on its axis, you know, that was... a twist. And again, you know, we've mentioned I Let You Go. I think that happens in Claire's novel as well, that you just go, whoa, you're heading in that direction, now you're heading in a completely different one.
So a twist is something much more large scale, and a reveal, I mean, reveal, let's face it, is the third part of a joke, isn't it?
Well,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Kind of, it's quite a minor thing, a reveal. Important.
But a reveal could be, you know, now that I have you and the girl in my power, Mr. Bond, at the end of... You know, all those Ian Fleming novels. That's really the last thing.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think, for instance, I'm sure a lot of you have read Before I Go to Sleep, but actually I think that's more of a reveal than a twist, even though it was very much marketed as a twist. You know, are you going to say that the revelation of the whodunit in every novel is a twist? I don't think so. I think that's the reveal.
The difference between a twist and a reveal is you've got your magician and he's got a hat. A reveal is when he takes a rabbit out of the hat. A twist would be if you took a kipper out.
Back to the camera.
Or a red herring, perhaps.
Yes, more appropriate.
Well, that was interesting. That's another other question. Yes.
I wanted to ask, in relation to writing books with twists and within the crime genre, do you ever worry that you're producing books that the reader just reads so fast because they want to get to the twist and find out, and that they're almost eating the prose too fast and missing some finer points?
Yes, in a word.
Yeah, and the other thing about a book with a killer twist is you're only going to read it once, right?
Most well, you might read it again to see how it was signposted.
But that's kind of reading as a writer, isn't it? Yeah. That's probably as true, that the twist only works on one reading, because thereafter you know what that will be.
Yeah, kind of. I've got to admit, it sort of bugs me slightly. And maybe because I started life as a poet, so I sort of want every sentence that I produce to be kind of glossy and for the reader to sort of enjoy the quality of the prose, I suppose, as well as the quality of the twist. And because I write books that are based in London, and it's a passion of mine, the history of London, I want to immerse people in that environment as well. So I think if people are just sort of... if I read my Amazon reviews and somebody just says, well, you know what, I guessed the twist by page 30, I kind of think, yeah, but you know what, there's more going on. There's a bit more to it.
Never read your Amazon reviews.
It's a mistake, it really is. Yeah.
I think as well, I mean, you know, it seems that a lot of the time reviewers will, not reviewers, like esteemed reviewers like Laura.
Watch it.
Yeah. Never get it on again. But, you know, say if you... reading Amazon reviews or Goodreads or book club reviews, that there is a kind of correlation between how good a book is and how quickly a reader has read it.
I stayed up all night to read this book.
Yeah, exactly. I read it in a day or whatever. And although, you know, that's kind of bittersweet, because yes, you want somebody to be so engrossed in your book that they don't want to put it down, but equally you're thinking, bloody hell, you know, I sweated 18 months over that book and you've just read it in a day. And then you get the emails that will say, I just wanted to check a part of that plot that, you know, did she do that, which is fine, but I just think, well, is it my fault that you know, maybe I should have slowed down the pace somewhat? And I remember when I handed in my first book to my agent, and she said, you've got to let people breathe, you know? So she asked me to go back and kind of almost put my foot on the brakes in some scenes, because I think it's a reading experience. It's not great to be kind of going at 100 miles an hour through it, you know. And that's the kind of...
you're going to like that.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, that's down to pacing as well.
Mm. One more question. This is it. Oh, well done. I was going to say it's the chair's nightmare. There never is one more, but there is, yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, maybe if you stand up, that would be good.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Why is it that a male psychopath is always like so much more layered, and there's, you know, all this childhood issues, but female psychopaths always just like around and really crazy.
They're kind of bunny boilers.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, she isn't in Gone Girl.
No, I think she's a very layered character. I mean, that's why I liked reading about Amy, and I think she's a terrific creation. And I think it's underlining the importance of character in these novels as well as twist.
I mean, I agree. I've written a female sociopath in one of my books, and you know, I had great fun doing it, and actually I like writing mean female characters, because I don't buy into this notion that women aren't mean. You know, I think we're actually, when we're mean, we're much more clever about it, and that's much more interesting, and it really riles me that, you know, that we're not supposed to be.
Yeah, I wrote a character who is completely, you know, amoral and actually quite psychopathic in the way she behaves in my fourth Stratton novel, which is called A Willing Victim. But I did find the need to explain this by having a psychologist or someone say, well, she has a narcissistic personality disorder. And I did wonder afterwards if, had she been a male character, I would have felt the need to medicalise it.
Can I just jump in?
Not sure.
On that, exactly that point, because my main character is a woman who sells information to criminals, and she is herself a criminal. And publishers were really happy with this. And then I had a very interesting meeting with a TV company who had asked to meet me and then sat me down and said, but it would be so much better if she had a mental illness to explain why she's breaking the law. And what was interesting was the person who was telling me that, a very esteemed TV producer, was female. She was saying, if you're looking, you know, for her, going for a mainstream TV audience, you have to explain, and she was very apologetic about it, but you have to explain women's transgression in terms of mental illness.
Okay. Yeah, that's like actually the male and female artist myth. If you get people like Jackson Pollock and people like that, everyone's interested in the drunkenness and the crazy behaviour and all that. Women like Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, they're interested in nuts, yeah. This, nuts. And that's the myth. Different for men and for women.
Good point, I'm not sure. Well said, Laura.
Yeah, right, okay.
Just trying to summon up the characters.
I wrote a serial killer over three novels, actually, a female serial killer, and I haven't been accused of being you one of them, actually. You didn't accuse me of being sexist or anything. Yeah, thank you. Right, okay, well, we have reached the end of the hour. However, as I think you probably know, the authors will go down the far end and will be very happy to talk to you and to sign the books. So let me just sign off by saying thank you very much to Kate Rhodes, Helen Giltrow, Laura Wilson, and Colette Macbeth.
And for Dogs.